Hi, MWTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and we are being joined by
Robert Glasper.
The Grammy and Emmy-winning artist is about to come to the Birchmere in Alexandria, Virginia on November 7th. Hey, thanks so much for joining us, Robert.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Now, where are you in pandemic life has been insane this year. Is this your first time back, is this your first time back out on the road, or where are you?
No, I'm in L.A., this is probably going to be my second time leaving. I came to D.C. My first time leaving was I went to D.C. I played at the March on Washington on August 28th.
Gotcha. And so this is
time back. Yeah, exactly. Especially like playing in front of an audience, you know. I've done some streaming stuff. But.
Well, what was it, real quick before we move on? Tell me about that. What was it like playing at the March?
Oh man, it was amazing, and it was an honor to play there, knowing the history of the march, and you know that's where Martin Luther King did his "I Have a Dream" speech, and seeing all the people, you know, there, united, and it just felt like I was a part of history, you know what I mean? And it was me and Derek Hodge and George Clinton, we performed together, so it was a really cool thing, cool experience.
Yeah, a very historic time, and so you'll always be able to look back on that for sure.
Absolutely.
All right, cool. Well, I'm excited about your show. I don't want you to spoil the set list entirely, but you know, give us a little teaser on what sort of stuff we're gonna hear.
You know what's funny? Before I do shows, I never premeditate really all the songs because I like to read the crowd. You know what I mean? You never know when you go to an audience. My audience is so vast. It really depends. If I have a lot of young people, that changes my set list. If I have a lot of older people, that changes my set list. If it's in between, that changes my set list. So sometimes I go out there knowing the first song or maybe the first two songs. But other than that, I like to give each audience their own specific show. I try not to come with a preset menu. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let me quarterback this thing a little chronologically. Take me back to the very beginning. You born in Houston in 1978. What sort of stuff did you grow up listening to? You know, like who were your music idols back then?
Yeah. So my mom was a singer, and she sang in all the different kinds of clubs. That's literally what she did. That's what her job was. So during the week she was singing at a R&B club, at a funk club, at a jazz club, and even she sang country music. Literally, there was one day a week where she was singing at a barn that had a stage, and then on Sundays, she was the minister of music at the church. So in my house, you never knew what you were gonna walk into the house and what my mom was gonna be playing, because she's all over the place. You know, she's a musical mutt, which is why I'm like that. You know what I mean? So, I mean, you could walk in the house, you can hear Liza Minnelli, you can hear Aretha Franklin, you can hear Ella Fitzgerald, you can hear just anything at my house. So that's the reason why I love, going through genre so much. And I kind of blur the lines because I kind of grew up like that,
For sure. I love that phrase, musical mutt. I love it. So you're growing up around it all over, all around you. When would you say you took it seriously as a career? Like, was it, I know you went to, was it New School for Jazz and Contemporary Music in New York? That's where you met your partner in crime there a little bit. But is that when you think you took it serious?
I think I started taking it serious in 11th grade, maybe. I would say that's when it clicked and I was like, I think I want to do this. I was in 11th grade and I went to a performing arts high school. So there was a lot of kids my age that loved jazz and that were playing it at a very high level. That love art in general. Everybody in my school was very high level. So, it was good competition and it made me thrive to be better. So when I was around 11th grade, that's when I was like, I think I could do this. And that's when I said, I got to go to New York. Because I know to make it as a musician, you got to go to New York, especially back then. So that's what I put I directed all of my energy to trying to get to New York. So I auditioned for the new school. I got in, they gave me a full scholarship, and then I was out. I actually got my scholarship in 11th grade. So I got my full scholarship to New School in 11th grade, and I got a full scholarship to Berklee College of Music in 11th grade. And neither one of those schools, you need an SAT. So I never took the SAT. So
really?
when I was a senior in high school, all my friends are studying for the SAT and shit. And I was just walking around whistling because I already had my full scholarships in the bag.
Hey, you never
took it. It was awesome.
So when you're there, you met Bilal? I never
Bilal,
know how to
yep.
say it. Yeah.
Yep. Bilal, yep. yep.
What was that first meeting like? And how do you think that, you know, was that like a seminal moment in your life?
Yeah, 100%. Meeting Bilal definitely was a shift in my whole life, my career. We met the first day of school because what happens is when you're a freshman at the school, they call all the freshmen in the room and they call you up on stage one by one, like to form a band. So they'll call up a random drummer, a random bass player, a random piano player, a random singer, and call you up on stage, and you have to talk to each other and figure out something to play in front of the rest of the students. And they happened to call me and Bilal up on stage together. And I always make the joke, we never left the stage. You know, 20 years later, we're still on the stage together, you know? So the reason, you know, Bilal actually, we became really tight, and one of our teachers had a friend that had a studio around the corner from the school. So he was like, hey, y'all should go to my friend's studio and record some music. Cause they always saw me and Bilal together working on music in a practice room, and they saw something in us. So we ended up going to this guy's house all the time. And it turned out his name was Aaron Comis. He was the drummer for the Spin Doctors.
Oh, nice.
And so we recorded Bilal's whole demo there at his house. And at the end of our freshman year, Bilal got signed to a record deal with Interscope Records. Jimmy Iovine signed him. So from that point on, you know, I was his music director. And, you know, I helped him do a lot of his album came out. We ended up going on tour a lot, opening up for, you know, like Erykah Badu and Common and things of that nature, The Roots, you know, so that being with him thrusted me into that hip hop R&B world, you know what I mean? And that's where my career really began, with this straddling both lines, because of being on the road with Bilal. Then I'm meeting, you know, all the hip hop cats, all the soul R&B cats, and I'm, you know, I have a rapport with them. At the same time, I was heavy on the jazz scene, so, you know, I'm on tour with Roy Hargrove and Christian McBride and Russell Malone and Terrence Blanchard and Kenny Garrett, all these different people, while at the same time touring with Bilal, doing the soul hip hop R&B thing. So I literally was walking in both things at the same time. So that really shaped my career, you know?
Well, yeah, and we're all blessed because of it. And a lot of those people you mentioned, you wind up coming back around featuring on your albums too. So that's kind of cool to hear how that all started.
Gotcha.
Well, I mean, man, we don't have time to go through all of them, but, you know, you had Mood, you had Canvas, In My Element, Double Booked, you rattled them off. But then, you know, the one all of our listeners will remember is, you know, Black Radio in 2013.
Uh-huh.
Won the Grammy, Best R&B. I think Lupe was on there, Badu, Layla Hathaway.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
Just memories of putting that one together. I remember there were some cool covers of like David Bowie, Nirvana. Like that album had everything. Remember memories of putting that together?
Oh yeah, man, that was a trip. That was a nightmare actually, because you know it's an album with I don't know how many, maybe 12 special guests or something like that. So you got to think, you have each person has a manager, each person has an assistant, each person has a label, each person has a lawyer. And you have to go through all these people and figure out, you know, scheduling and all these things. So the scheduling stuff was a nightmare. I actually canceled the album like two or three times because I couldn't get the scheduling together. And back then, you know, people were more in the room with each other. They weren't so much sending files back and forth. You know what I mean? So I had to have everybody in the room because that was my thing. It's a live band with the singers there. And that was my thing. So I actually canceled the record two or three times. And then, you know, this one time I was on tour, it might've been, you know, I don't know, 6 to 8 months after I canceled, and or maybe a little short, I don't know, 4 or 5 months, something, a few months. I'm on tour with my band in Europe and my manager randomly calls me and says, I don't know what happened, but everybody's manager called me and they're all the artists are available next week. And I was like, what? Oh, snap. So we canceled a bunch of my tour. And I flew to LA, and I actually didn't have enough songs because since the scheduling never really happened, and I never really got a strong hold on the guest, I didn't finish writing the songs or even knew what we were going to do. So when I got back to LA, I didn't have many songs. That's why I did covers. That's why there's like 6 covers on the album, because I didn't have any songs.
Right, so, right.
You know, so it was really cool in that respect, because it was really like people would get to the studio. I'm like, hey, what do you want to do? You know, and so it was very much a jazz recording session, if you will, because it was kind of like, you know, spare the moment, you know, in the moment, trying to figure stuff out. Not your typical way of doing a quote unquote R&B record. You know, the planning was way more different. With the music, but I'm glad I did that because, you know, I love the way we ended up doing the covers, you know what I mean? And I love so many genres of music. That's why I have Nirvana. That's like Teen Spirit's been one of my favorite songs since I was in sixth grade when it first came out, you know what I mean? When I saw the video.
You had Teen Spirit.
I had Teen Spirit in my pocket at some point, you know, but the Cherish the Day and the David Bowie drink, that was random as hell. Like that album, Space Oddity, I had it in my iTunes, and literally a week before the recording, while I'm in Europe, I had my iTunes on like, you can put it in like a shuffle, so it plays random songs from your iTunes, and that song came on, Letter to Hermione. Wow. And as soon as I had never heard it before. I had the album in my iTunes, but I don't remember ever hearing that song, you know? I think my friend Zach turned me on to the album, you know, and I never really got a chance to check the whole thing out. As soon as it came on, I heard Bilal in my head. I was like, oh my God, this Bilal will kill this. It's amazing. And we got to LA. I sent it to Bilal. He learned it on the plane. He flew to LA. We did that song in one take. He's reading the lyrics while he's singing the song. Same thing with Cherish Today. That's one take only. Wow. Matter of fact, that's the sound check, because I had to fade it in, because right before it fades in, Layla was saying, mic check 1-2, 1-2, mic check 1-2. And she was reading lyrics on her cell phone, and that was the first take. And I'm not a fan of doing multiple takes if there's no need for it. I'm more of a first time magic person.
Right.
Like literally 95% of anything I've recorded ever is the first take. Even if it's just something about the magic of the spirit of a first take, you know? So most of the songs on all of my albums are first take. Just most of them, actually.
Wow, I didn't know that. That's awesome. All right, cool. And then I know, so you follow up with Black Radio 2, and then also I think that same year you were on, you know, Kendrick's To Pimp a Butterfly. Actually, yep. You guys won for that, for These Walls. Yep. My buddy just wrote Kendrick's biography. If you ever had a chance, check that out.
I'm reading. Which one are you talking about? For Pimp a Butterfly?
Marcus Moore, it's the Butterfly Effect.
Butterfly Effect, yeah. I started reading it already.
Really? Yeah, he works up at Bandcamp up at in Brooklyn. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know, he interviewed me for the book.
Oh,
so
man, you're in there.
Yeah, yeah. So he sent it to me. He sent it to me like last week. I've literally been reading it all week. It's such a good book.
Yeah, Marcus is a good dude. That Small World.
Absolutely.
But anyway, memories of These Walls really fast. I mean, you know, you had no idea, you know, To Pimp a Butterfly would be such a, I feel like we'll be looking back on that, you know, decades from now. But the fact that you were playing keys on with him on that.
Exactly.
You know, what was that like constructing that together?
So it's crazy. I played on 9 songs on that album. And When Good Kid, M.A.A.D City came out, Kendrick's first album, well, first major label album came out, Good Kid, M.A.A.D City, I called one of my boys, Terrace Martin, who's one of the main producers on that record. And I said, yo, Good Kid, M.A.A.D City, so dope. I love this album. When Kendrick does another album, I have to be a part of it somehow, some way. And he was like, bet, I got you. Fast forward, I'm in L.A. doing my record Covered. It's a trio record I did live at Capitol Records. And I did cover songs, trio. And during the second night, I believe the second night, cover was 2 nights of recording live with a studio audience. The first night, Before I go in to record, John Mayer walks over to my session. He's like, hey, I never met him before. He's like, hey, Robert, right? I was like, yeah. He's like, man, I'm a fan of your music. I'm recording my new album next door in Studio B, if you want to come by after you finish. I was like, bet. So I went by after I finished. I jammed with John for like 2 or 3 hours, just me and him, recorded it. And then the next day, Terrace calls me like, yo, when you finish your session, come by Dr. Dre's studio. I'm here with Kendrick. I was like, bet. So I jump in the car after I finish that and I drive over and Kendrick's there and they just start pulling up all these songs that they recorded. Complexions and Mortal Man. Like, Mortal Man was a different day. That was with the orchestra. But a bunch of songs. I, You, This Dick Ain't Free, blah, 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 that one. A bunch of them. Anyway, so he would pull the song up and be like, listen to it and play what you hear. So I would listen to it, and then in one take, I would play what I heard. I only did one take on each song. And then they used like nine of the song. I only got credit for 5, but it's cool. It was a fast, very fast thing. But these walls particularly, I did in Terrace's garage. I was at his house and he said, yo, it was kind of a by chance, like, hey, you're here. You want to play keys on this song I did for Kendrick? And I was like, all right, cool. So he pulled it up and I started warming up on it. I just started playing like some scales and some fast kind of thing, just kind of warming up and messing around with the changes for what I thought was before he started recording. But Terrace was recording me already. That's why when you hear the song, there's a solo in the middle of the song, a keyboard solo. And that's me playing the keyboard solo, but I didn't know I was playing a solo. That's my warm up. And they just cut it and put it in the song.
See, they're just like you are a first take guy. They look like your warm up.
They literally like warm up. So that's what you hear, like literally my warm up. I didn't know that happened until the album came out. Because if you remember when the album dropped, it dropped surprisingly, no one knew. So it kind of dropped out of nowhere. It was like, oh, shit, the album's out. So when I heard it, I was like, oh, snap, there's a solo in the middle. I'm awesome. I made it.
Look, Ma.
Look.
That's so great. Well, I mean, yeah. What I think so cool about it is, you've also been able to sort of transition onto the big screen. I'm a huge movie guy. So how did Don Cheadle tap you to do the Miles Davis biopic?
That's funny. Don texted, he tweeted me. I didn't know him at all, but he talked to Vince Wilburn, a friend of mine, who's Miles Davis's nephew. And they were in cahoots and doing this movie. And my name came up and Don was like, I love Robert's work. And he tweeted me like, hey, I love your Trio album, In My Element. I was like, wait a minute, you're Don Cheadle. And then, we DM'd each other, started texting eventually. And then he was like, I'm working on this Miles Davis movie. Have you ever did a score before? And I said, yeah. And I literally have never done a score before. So I lied. But it worked out. We started working on it. And it was hard at first because he was in the middle of doing House of Lies. And he was actually directing some of those episodes. So, and at the same time, I was in Europe on a duo piano tour with Jason Moran, doing dual piano concerts. So while I'm doing that, I'm going after the shows of me and Jason, I'm going to my hotel room trying to score a movie. And Jason at the same time was scoring Selma. So we would do our duo shows and then go to our hotel rooms and score movies. But after that, me and Don finally got in the room together and we were able to finish it up. And it was amazing, man. He's such a great dude and he's very knowledgeable with music. He actually got a music scholarship in college. So Don knows some of his stuff in music. So it was a smooth ride doing that. And we actually won a Grammy for that, for best soundtrack to a movie. We beat out like Suicide Squad and Straight Outta Compton and the Amy Winehouse Story. Like, Don didn't think we're gonna win to the point he didn't even go to the Grammys. He went and played golf. And I told him, I was like, while I was getting dressed, I was like, yo, you got to come. He's like, man, I'm not going to those things. I mean, people like Don are always walking somebody's red carpet, So he's like, I was like, well, if we win, you got to get dressed and come down and walked the red carpet with me. He was like, okay, if we win. Got to be honest, I didn't think we were going to win either. I mean, Suicide Squad, Straight Outta Compton, Amy Winehouse, I'm like, we're not winning, but good try. And when we won, I called him from the stage. I'm like, we won! So he got dressed and came down. And we went up walking the red carpet together. It was such an awesome thing. And that kind of, that springboarded me doing other projects and documentaries and other movies, you know?
Yeah, including Ava DuVernay's 13th, which got me, I think everyone listening to this, just stop what you're doing now and watch it. It should be required viewing, like in schools. That thing was amazing.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But you, yeah, and Common win the Emmy together for Letter to the Free on that.
Yep.
Talk about, basically what I just said about how that documentary is so important.
Yeah, it's a documentary called The 13th, basically about the 13th Amendment, which is, you know, basically talks about the incarcerating of African Americans and some of the laws and things that were passed to kind of make it impossible for you to deal with in that world of incarceration and all the little laws they made to stop the progress of African Americans in those days, which a lot of them are still implementing now. So it's a very educational film and very important to watch. And a lot of things in there most people don't even know. You know, and it's a great documentary. And shout out to Jason Moran. Jason Moran did the actual score of the documentary. I ended up doing just the ending song. But the funny part about it, there's always a story with me with things, as you can see. But
oh, let's have it. I'm eating it up.
I was in Houston with my son, visiting family, and Common called me. He's like, hey, can you fly to LA now? Ava called me. She needs an ending song for this documentary. And I was like, I can't, man. And, you know, I was like, I have my son. And, you know, I travel a lot. So when I get time with my son, I try to stick to it, you know, because I'm always gone a lot, you know. So I was like, man, we just got here to Houston. We're seeing family. I can't come. I can't do it. And he was like, man, I'll fly to Houston. We'll do it in Houston. I was like, bet. We can do it here. Cool. You know, so he ended up getting on the plane. Him and Kareem Riggins, the producer, got on the plane, came down to Houston. And we went in the studio and came up with that song, Letter to the Free. And then like the next day, they flew to New York, put Bilal on it, and gave it to Ava. And they ended up winning Best Song for a Documentary. So I got an Emmy Award. It was awesome. And what's crazy about the Emmy Award is that, unlike other awards, like when you watch the Grammys, you know, they have a Grammy on stage for people to grab and say their speech, but that's not your Grammy. It's not inscripted at all. You give it backstage. All shows, you give your award backstage. All the major ones, you give your award backstage. And then they send you your Grammy 4 months later that has your inscription in it. You know, they send that to you later. The Emmy, when you get the Emmy on stage, you take that bad boy with you back to your seat.
Wow.
And it's heavy. And what they do, it's not inscripted on the thing. What they do, a few months later, they send you a thing you have to screw on that has, you know, your name and what you won for and all that. But the actual statue, you take home with you that night. You take it on with you, right? When you leave the stage from saying thank you, you take it back to your seat. It's really weird. And it's like sitting on your lap next to somebody who probably just lost, and it's weird. But
yeah, I've heard. That's bizarre. Yeah, I mean, I've heard awards called hardware, but in that, you literally have to put it together.
and then I had to get on the plane with it, and I for some reason at the after party, you go to the after party with your award, and everybody's sitting at the after party at the tables with their food with this award, and it's not small, and you know, I didn't know they had these boxes you can put the award in that you had to ask for at the party. That information never really got to me. So I put my Emmy like in a gym bag and when I flew back to New York the next day, I had to put it through the metal detector. You know, and everybody's like, the people that work in there like, what is this? Oh, they had to open it and they pulled it out. Everybody around was like, oh my God, that's an Emmy in your gym bag? Dude, you know, it's weird. It's hilarious.
That's great. A little a time to show off a little at TSA.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, you got the Emmy, you got the Grammy, man. Let's find a way to get you an Oscar and a Tony and get you that EGOT thing. You're halfway
100%. I'm halfway there, like Bon Jovi said. Living on a prayer.
Yeah, that popped up on your iPod after David Bowie.
Definitely.
Awesome, man. Well, you've been generous with your time. I appreciate it. This was great. Tons of good stories in there that I can use. So, again, everybody, it's Robert Glasper coming to the Birchmere in Alexandria, Virginia on November 7th. Thank you, sir. Yep. That was great.
No worries. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Talk to you later.
Word up.